I want to thank Toby for that generous introduction, and I'll ask your indulgence to let me simply read the remarks I prepared. I'll try to do so with some expression so it isn't drawl and monotone, but if I don't find some such vehicle for limiting my time, we may not get out of here in time for lunch. So let me begin by reading from the first page. During the past decade or so, we have seen a number of instances in which faithful Latter-day Saints have been subjected to various forms of church discipline by priesthood leaders, often, but not always, on the initiative of general authorities. The first large-scale example in recent times, to my knowledge, occurred in 1983, when a number of bishops and stake presidents were asked by Elder Mark E. Peterson to call in a dozen or so Dialogue and Sunstone authors for counseling about their associations with apostate publications. A year or so later, the authors of the Emma Smith biography were precluded by Fiat of the Twelve from speaking in official church meetings. During the past 2 years or so, eight authors who have published on doctrinal and historical issues in Dialogue and elsewhere, most of whom had been active and faithful church members, were excommunicated or otherwise disciplined. Church education employees have long been quietly enjoined from participating in Sunstone Symposia and from publishing their work in Dialogue or Sunstone. And in the wake of two widely publicized faculty terminations at BYU a year or so ago, many faculty from that university who had long felt free to take part in such scholarly activities now feel constrained to avoid such forums. Now, every organized religion has trouble with its intellectuals. Yet it is not only scholars and intellectuals in this church who have felt thus constrained by the exercise of priesthood authority. To my certain knowledge, church members in more than one stake have been forbidden by local priesthood leaders to participate in local study groups on pain of revoked temple recommends or other kinds of discipline. Other members have been denied temple recommends for rejecting literal interpretations of biblical accounts like Noah's flood, or for using some other basis than full gross income in calculating an honest tithing. Still others have been disciplined for publicly taking libertarian public policy positions in contrast to presumptive LDS church standards, as, for example, in the case of abortion, drug and alcohol use, and homosexual behavior, despite their own personal compliance with church standards in question. Recall, for example, the differential church response to statements of Cecilia Farr on the one hand and Mitt Romney in Massachusetts on the other hand, both of whom took, as a matter of public policy, a pro-choice position on the abortion issue, though in their own personal behavior and preferences, they were pro-life. Of course, Cecilia got in trouble for it, and Mitt Romney didn't. And on a second-hand or hearsay basis, I gather that many others have seen similar incursions of priesthood authority into the personal lives of even active church members. So one wonders what is going on here. It is not my purpose today simply to multiply horror stories. What I propose to do from here on, rather, is first to characterize and analyze the present situation in somewhat detached terms. Then I will undertake to explain why and how we have arrived at this predicament. Finally, on the basis of my own personal experience and such wisdom as I might have acquired, I shall suggest some things that we as church members might do to cope with this situation and perhaps even to help ameliorate it. During most of my adult life, I have carefully observed the growth and development of the church, both as a loyal insider and from the more detached perspective of a professional social scientist. Like many of you, I've also been an avid reader of LDS history. On the basis of all such observations, I must say that I find the current environment in the church to be unprecedented in my lifetime. It is inconceivable to me that the exertions of priesthood authority, which we have recently seen, particularly on the parts of general authorities, could have occurred during the administrations of Heber J. Grant, George Albert Smith, or David O. McKay, at least while these presidents were in good health. Those administrations represent the years of my upbringing in the church and of my formal education. I recall, now with some embarrassment, the smug satisfaction that I took as a younger man in the assurance that at least Mormons did not have heresy trials like the Catholic Church had. I can't say that anymore. For it is difficult, at least from a public record, to see how else one could characterize most of the recent cases of disciplined LDS scholars. To be sure, there was the Fon Brody case in the mid-40s. But that case was not a simple heresy trial. It was complicated by the special and uncharacteristic animus and outrage of the McKay family, and by suspicions, largely unfounded, that Brody had taken advantage of her family connections to get sensitive historical materials. I regard the Brody case as a rare exception to the absence of 20th century Mormon heresy trials. Even the more recent case of Sonia Johnson does not qualify as a simple heresy trial, for, as I personally heard her concede in public, it was her joining in legal action against the church that precipitated her trial, not simply her outspoken and published feminist views. I think we have to go back into 19th century Utah to find historical periods during which church leaders disciplined members for espousing unauthorized doctrine, for resisting priesthood control over political or economic preferences, or for disobeying priesthood instructions relating to one's personal life. We have to go back, in other words, to the days of theocracy, and particularly to times of crisis like the Reformation of the 1850s or the Godbeite defections of the 1860s. I do not mean to exaggerate the parallels between then and now, but there seems to have been then, as now, a sense of crisis among the general authorities, a felt need to up the ante, as it were, for church membership. All of that somehow seems more understandable when the 19th century church was struggling for its very existence against a hostile outside world. With the coming of the 20th century, however, the church increasingly sought and obtained acceptance and assimilation with the outside world. This process seems to have included a sincere abandonment of earlier theocratic policies and a fuller embrace of secular American tolerance and civil liberties, even within the church. For libertarian ideas, after all, do fit well with traditional Mormon commitments to free agency. Worldly scholarship was encouraged earlier in the century in the expectation that it would eventually vindicate the Mormon truth claims. And homegrown Mormon intellectuals who personified that posture were called to the Quorum of the Twelve, like Widsoe, Talmadge, McKay, and Merrill, or were recruited to the church education system, like Lowell Bunyan. The authority of the prophets was honored and taken seriously, but there was no claim, even implicitly, of infallibility. That was only for Catholics, again. Indeed, in the mid-40s, when an overzealous church functionary prepared a ward teaching lesson declaring that when our leaders speak, the thinking has been done, the idea was personally repudiated by the president of the church. In those days, the church seemed more hospitable than it does now to intellectual diversity. What has happened since then is, as many of you know, the theme of my recent book. For perhaps the past three decades, we have been living through a period of increasing retrenchment, for which correlation is both a vehicle and a metaphor. This retrenchment seems to have been motivated by a growing perception on the parts of church leaders, general and local, that the church and its members are in grave spiritual and moral danger. Clearly, our leaders are not without grounds for that perception. Yet their efforts to contain the perceived threats have somehow produced a leaner and meaner feeling in the church, especially, I think, for scholars of my generation. At a time in which so many Mormons are preoccupied with material success and career advancement, and so many Mormon fathers are manifestly failing their wives and children, one can only feel some surprise that an apostle of the Lord would recently have identified feminists and scholars as a major threat to the church, even if they're only so-called scholars. The repudiation of scholars and feminists must also have been met on the other side, with some arched eyebrows on the parts of feminists Emmeline B. Wells and Susan Young Gates, and of scholars like B.H. Roberts and John A. Widsoe. It seems almost as though some of our leaders, in their efforts to protect the saints from the surrounding world, have fallen back on organizational controls more appropriate to an earlier theocratic era than to the age of Americanization. Yet if we can understand a fuller context for all of this, we will, I believe, see that the problem is neither an outpouring of unrighteous dominion by church leaders, nor one of wholesale apostasy and defiance by the saints, whether scholars or not, and whether excommunicated or not. Rather, the parties involved, both as discipliners and as disciplinees, are simply not sharing the same definition of what constitutes a loyal Latter-day Saint. How could this divergence in definitions occur in such a unified, monolithic church? I would argue that this divergence in definitions has occurred because the church today does not have clear boundaries defining the limits of legitimate priesthood authority, on the one hand, or defining the requisite types and degrees of member obedience, on the other hand. Many priesthood leaders, and especially general authorities, in trying conscientiously to guard the flock against the wolves of sin and apostasy, apparently do not see many limits, other than the obvious scriptural ones, to their prerogatives as guardians. To be sure, it is hard to find specific guidelines in any church leadership manuals that would tell priesthood leaders how far they can legitimately go in pressing their demands for obedience from the saints. If some of the brethren seem to be acting in the spirit of 19th century theocracy, perhaps it is because the 20th century church has not yet defined the boundaries beyond which priesthood leaders must not go in attempting to control the personal decisions and behavior of the saints. During the early 20th century, church leaders gradually relinquished the kinds of surveillance and control over the lives of saints that seemed to have been available or even acceptable for, say, Jedediah Grant's stringent Reformation of 1856-58. And by now, at least three generations of saints have grown up in this century without the presumption that church leaders are entitled to control our public lectures and writings, theological or political, as long as we don't claim to speak for the church, or to control our private associations and assemblages, or our personal fashion and lifestyle choices that do not clearly violate established moral standards. It may well be that we have become too Americanized in our understandings and expectations of the limits on priesthood authority, but clearly we have been taken by surprise as we have watched a decade or so now of efforts by church leaders, general and local, to silence the public expression of unconventional theological opinions, to interfere with participation in Sunstone Symposia and various other activities of the unsponsored sector, to impose rules or at least guidelines upon hair and beard fashions, upon the kinds of books, drama, and music we enjoy, and even upon the private decisions of married couples regarding spousal roles and child spacing. Now, I am not talking here about moral suasion or remonstrances from church leaders, no matter how stringent these might be, for we expect guidance of that kind from prophets and leaders. I am talking about not moral suasion, but the imposition of disciplinary sanctions in these areas where we have not been accustomed to receiving them heretofore. It is this new situation, and not either church leader malfeasance or member disobedience, that has created the present predicament. It is the ambiguity in this predicament that is so confusing and disillusioning. It is as though our parents and even some of our siblings have suddenly turned on us with new punishments for violating rules that we did not even know were there. Furthermore, the rules have not been spelled out even yet. Is every member who lectures or publishes his or her theological speculations in jeopardy of church discipline? Or only those who do so in unapproved forums? Cleon Skousen, Dwayne Crowther, and many others have made careers of publishing their speculations on doctrine and prophecy, and have found their work marketed through Deseret Book Company even now. Betty Eady, an LDS member claiming to have visited the spirit world during a near-death experience, has made a fortune with a book that was on the New York Times bestseller list for at least a year, despite claims in the book about the other world that would surely constitute at least dubious doctrine. But since she seems to be neither a feminist nor a scholar, perhaps she is safe. Or is it only that we must avoid certain doctrinal topics or areas as we do our research, lecturing, and publishing? As long as we avoid, say, the topics of post-manifesto polygamy, mother in heaven, priesthood for women, the temple, or historicity of the Book of Mormon, are other topics okay? Or is it our rhetoric that can get us disciplined? If our tones are too strident or too angry, no matter what our topic, is that the main rub? Or is it a matter simply of acquiring an indelible label? Once a person has been placed on some list maintained by the Committee to Strengthen Church Members, wonderful Orwellian term, once on such a list, can he or she expect anything he or she writes to be given special scrutiny and to be forwarded with the offending passages well highlighted to the local stake president? We have been given no public guidance in any of these questions, and we are left simply to make such inferences as we can. Yet the most vexing ambiguity is found less in matters of content and outlet, perhaps, than in a whole host of procedural questions about the church disciplinary process. One does not expect, of course, that the church will follow procedures derived from the U.S. Constitution, to say nothing of those approved by the ACLU. But we do have a right to expect our leaders to follow some predictable procedures, especially those found in official publications like the General Handbook of Instructions for Church Leaders, a full third of which, by the way, is devoted to the subject of church discipline. As I read that handbook, it seems clear to me that all disciplinary procedures against a church member are to start at the local level. There is no provision for a general authority to reach down into a ward or stake to initiate disciplinary action, except perhaps just as any member of the church might do, which is to come forth and make a formal charge of some kind against a putative offender. Disciplinary councils at the general level have always been strictly appellate in their jurisdiction. This presumption of local jurisdiction is apparently understood even by the Committee to Strengthen Church Members, which is supposed to function only as a kind of clipping service, to use Elder Oaks's term, which simply sends questionable published work through channels for disciplinary decisions, if any, to be made ultimately by stake presidents. Yet, aside from the work of this committee, which after all is staffed only by church civil service employees, general authorities have sometimes apparently intervened personally in stake affairs to make sure that a certain member was appropriately disciplined, if only by revocation of a temple recommend, overriding any hesitancy that the stake president himself might have had about proceeding against that member. Even at the stake level, some members have had their temple recommends summarily revoked without any due process beyond an informal and hostile encounter with a stake president, an action which, again, is not covered by the general handbook. Such a curtailment of member privilege and status, constituting in effect partial disfellowshipment, would seem to require a hearing before some sort of formal counsel. There is still another aspect to this procedural ambiguity, and that is in the nature of the charges brought against members when they face disciplinary councils. Since priesthood leaders do not discuss publicly the proceedings of these councils, it is difficult for third parties to learn about the details of these charges, except to the extent that they are disclosed to the disciplined member in question, or through an inadvertent slip by a leader to the press, which has been known to happen. Of course, some details are sometimes given in writing to the member, in which case we can get more precise, a more precise idea of the charges. In most cases, the charges have usually included apostasy, quote unquote, or conduct unbecoming a member of the church, quote unquote. In the general handbook, a few particulars are given in the operational definition of apostasy, but there are no clues about the operational meaning of conduct unbecoming a member. In some cases, the main issue seems to have been simply disobedience to priesthood leaders, either as an instance of conduct unbecoming or as a charge in its own right. Now, a demand for obedience to priesthood leaders suggests a special quandary of its own. All the scriptural demands for obedience that I have ever seen refer either to obedience to the Lord Himself or obedience to gospel principles. I know of no scripture enjoining us to obey priesthood leaders. And even in the temple, the obedience covenant focuses directly on the Lord. When priesthood leaders call upon us to obey commandments known to have been issued by the Lord, or to have been explicitly and publicly set forth in directives from the First Presidency or the Twelve, they are clearly on firm ground and are entitled to our compliance. However, when the same leaders, individually or severally, demand our obedience to rules lacking such legitimacy, our obligations as church members are, once again, very ambiguous. Sometimes a leader will cite obedience in its own right as though there were a separate principle of the gospel called obedience. But that begs the question of whether the directive we are to obey is a legitimate one. There is no such thing as a principle of obedience in the abstract. We are obedient to someone or to some gospel principle. We therefore cannot commit ourselves to unqualified obedience in principle. We must be shown that the particular command to be obeyed is legitimate in its own right. Otherwise, we are turning over our moral agency to him whom we obey, a policy presumably tested and rejected in the war in heaven. Such, then, is the predicament in which we find ourselves now as a church. It is not that most of our leaders are mean-spirited or motivated by unrighteous dominion, nor is it that our scholars and others who seem to be testing the boundaries are faithless apostates. It is that the boundaries themselves are ambiguous. And as long as they are ambiguous, they will continue to be contested, partly in an effort to find them. However, to find them only in the breach, and thus to suffer the sanctions for unintended disobedience, is a very demoralizing and spiritually corrosive process. I think that the tension in the present ambiguous situation would be somewhat relieved if the rules which recent excommunicants have ostensibly broken were to be clearly and publicly articulated for all the world to see. Then church members would know ahead of time what sorts of restrictions to expect upon their writing, speaking, political activities, entertainment choices, conduct of spousal relationships, and other matters heretofore understood as matters of personal choice. Those saints who find these restrictions too onerous can opt to leave the church without rancor or stigma. Those who stay in will presumably find a balance between agency and obedience that they can live with. Investigators considering baptism can be informed of these fairly expansive priesthood prerogatives, along with their lessons on tithing, the law of chastity, and the other commandments, which would probably reduce the baptismal rate somewhat. At this juncture, I feel the need to clarify a couple of things. First, I do not mean to suggest that there are not already some clear grounds for excommunication or other forms of church sanction and discipline. Many of these certainly are spelled out in the leadership handbook. One of these is a violation of the law of chastity, especially for members endowed in the temple. Another is making common cause with the enemies of the church and fighting against the church as though a de facto outsider. Still another is fostering schism in the church by following alternative claimants to divine authority, which fundamentally has been the offense, I believe, of the various polygamy sects, the Order of Aaron, and more recently the millennial survivalists based in southern and central Utah. The boundaries in these matters have always seemed clear enough to me. I see ambiguity about the rules only in the kinds of cases I have been discussing today earlier. Let me also clarify, however, a second point. in calling for certain new rules to be spelled out, I do not mean to endorse a Pharisee-like checklist of do's and don'ts. I rejoice in the scripture that assures us that we need not be commanded in all things. Here I am talking only about rules and obligations that are being used to define and determine the very terms of our membership in the church, or at least our good standing in the church. If we are to be commanded in anything, it should be in those things, all of them. Otherwise, we shall continue to face not only ambiguity in what the terms of membership are, but inconsistency and inequity in the criteria and gravity of the sanctions, as some bishops and stake presidents will inevitably be more conservative and punitive than will others in essentially the same kinds of cases. Now, how have we gotten to this predicament? If I am right in my diagnosis about our present predicament, then the next question is, how have we gotten to where we are? Many reasons can be suggested. But the most important ones, in my opinion, are sociological and are not to be attributed simplistically to the initiatives of conservative church leaders as individuals. It is, of course, tempting to point to this or that general authority or stake president or bishop who might have made himself especially conspicuous in leading or provoking a given disciplinary proceeding. Yet we should resist that temptation, for we will understand much better the recent developments in the church if we recognize the larger social and organizational context in which individual leaders feel constrained to act. Besides the general retrenchment motif, which I referred to before, I would point to the following specific organizational developments. First, and in some ways the most important and most obvious, is the rapid growth of the church, requiring, as in all organizations, increased bureaucracy to manage complexity and concomitantly a greater social and emotional distance between leaders and members. Second, with this greater complexity and the growing diversity among church members, has come an understandably greater concern among church leaders for their potential loss of control over the doctrines and practices of the church. Third, this same growth, complexity, and diversity, along with geographic dispersion of church membership, have all but destroyed the familiar family connections which used to exist throughout the church, even in wards and stakes outside Utah. In California, where I was reared, it was common for members of the same stake or even the same ward to have migrated from the same towns or regions of Utah, and therefore have known each other's relatives, indeed, if not each other, from childhood. Mavericks are much easier to tolerate if we know they come from devout and loyal families, or if they have influential relatives who can vouch for them. On the other hand, it is much easier to suspect the loyalty or even the stability of a heretical-sounding ward member whose background we don't know, especially if he or she does not have an elite Mormon name like Smith, Young, Richards, Romney, and so on. Fourth, church leaders in recent years, whether general or local leaders, are especially likely to be recruited from the secular corporate world, where control is always top-down and there is little tolerance for either dissent or divergence from official policy. Fifth, new career possibilities have developed in the church. There are two kinds of church careers. The first might be called church civil service, as in the church education system, and all the people who occupy that 20-some-story high-rise office building in Salt Lake. General authorities don't have their offices in there. It's all the church civil service employees. In these cases, one's livelihood and secular advancement, not only one's church membership status, depend upon strict adherence to policy and often even to the preferences of individual file leaders. The second kind of career in the church consists of what might be called parallel or secondary careers in the lay ministry itself. We are fond of telling the world that we do not have a professional clergy, which is technically true enough. But we do have thousands of men and a few women who constitute, in effect, a career clergy, who move up the ranks of office from local to regional to general over a 20 or 25-year period that parallels their primary secular careers. Occasionally, ambition in these secondary careers gets in the way of persuasion, gentleness, meekness, and love unfeigned when it comes to handling dissent. There is a special danger, of course, when a given leader has both his primary career and his secondary career in the church, as in, again, CES. The sixth factor, the training of priesthood leaders, especially at the local level, does not include clear guidelines about the scope or limitations of their authority over the saints, especially their authority in matters outside of church programs or jurisdiction, like private study groups or symposia. Beyond the general scriptural injunction against unrighteous dominion, the training of local leaders includes little or no indication of what would constitute an abuse of authority by a bishop or a stake president, or even a general authority in the kinds of matters I've been discussing. Now, none of these six factors can be attributed to the volition of any particular individuals, still less to any conspiracy among church leaders to make life difficult for intellectuals and other unconventional members. Yet all of these organizational factors, and doubtless others as well, create the context within which church leaders at all levels make their decisions. Thus, in the absence of professional ministerial norms or training which might better define the limits of their legitimate authority over member private activities, our priesthood leaders are inclined to fall back on leadership concepts and styles from the corporate world in dealing with the flock, especially when members from whom they are often socially quite distant especially with members from whom they are often socially quite distant and about whom they have little personal knowledge or experience. To be sure, our leaders are ultimately still responsible as individuals for their decisions, but we must understand and appreciate the context of cross pressures that influence those decisions. Such an understanding might not assuage the pain and strain thereby introduced into church relationships, but at least it might help us avoid personal recriminations and ill-advised reactions. Now, I recognize that it's hard to resist personal animosity against leaders in the church or elsewhere who seem to have been unnecessarily harsh in their treatment of unconventional members. I recognize, too, that the damage done in such cases, not only to the individuals involved but to their families, can seem hard to forgive. Yet we must all remember that ultimate judgment remains with the Lord. Each leader, from the greatest to the least, and that includes many of us, will eventually be called upon to account for the conduct of his or her stewardship. Any of us, leader or not, who encumbers another's spiritual progress or who undermines another's testimony will have to account for it. Meanwhile, though, each of us must also take personal responsibility for his or her own testimony and not allow ourselves to be driven away by the actions of any church leaders, whether they are right or wrong. Now, a few words about what we can do about all this. If, as I have argued, the changed intellectual climate in the church is attributable mainly to sociological and organizational developments over which individual leaders have little control, then what can we do to relieve the tension that we sometimes feel in our relationships with leaders? I should make clear that the rest of my remarks are directed to those among us who still care about church membership. I recognize that some Latter-day Saints have come to feel so alienated and disaffected by the changes in the church or in themselves that they no longer care about their membership. What follows might not seem so relevant to them. However, for those who are still struggling and trying to maintain their bonds to the church, I hope this will be helpful. In a 1990 Sunstone article, I offered what I called a Decalogue for Dissenters, which I think addresses in part the question of how to manage this tension. Beyond that earlier advice, I would offer here the following suggestions to those who feel oppressed by the narrowing boundaries of Mormon acceptability. First, work first on establishing a close personal relationship with the Lord Himself. That might seem like a platitude at first glance, but I have learned that when I feel close to the Lord, I am spiritually and psychologically protected against whatever happens in the institutional church, including the extreme prospect of severe church discipline. It is unlikely that the Lord approves of everything that happens in the church. And the efficacy of actions by priesthood leaders depends ultimately upon the Lord's own ratification of those acts. The closer we are to the Lord, the better idea we will have of what He ratifies and does not ratify. It seems clear to me from Doctrine and Covenants section 121 that actions taken out of unrighteous dominion will not be recognized by the Lord. And that is an important reassurance for those who might have been unjustly treated by erring church leaders. Second thing we can do. Each of us must maintain his or her own sense of Mormon identity and not allow that to be taken away by anyone else, no matter how powerful. In that connection, I was warmed and touched by Michael Quinn's declaration, after all that had happened to him, that he thought of himself as a DNA Mormon. A third thing we can do. I think it is important also to give regular symbolic expression to our Mormon identity through wholehearted church activity and through continuous efforts to maintain the personal standards of the gospel that define that identity. For that reason, I think it is counterproductive to boycott church activity or ordinances, even partially, as a way of expressing sympathy with those whom we feel have been unfairly disciplined in the church. Such will do more to raise suspicion and call unfavorable attention to the complaining individual than to mellow the hearts of conservative priesthood leaders. On the other hand, there is much to be gained by maintaining or even intensifying our church activity and participation. For one thing, it is a symbolic expression of our belonging to the LDS community, as I've just indicated. Furthermore, it allows us to make positive and constructive contributions to the program of the church, and in the process, to discuss with our brothers and sisters some of our unconventional ideas. Besides, through church service and the cultivating of personal relationships with all kinds of leaders and members, we surround ourselves with a network of friends who can vouch for us when our loyalty might be questioned. That has happened to me more than once in recent years. Only this last spring, a copy of my latest dialogue article, was derivative from my book, came to the stake president's attention, duly forwarded from the Committee to Strengthen Church Members. Although the president was concerned about certain passages in my article, he consulted my bishop and others who knew me better than he did, even though I've been one of his high priest group leaders for 7 years. As a result of the reassurances that my stake president received from these others whom he consulted, he decided to drop the matter without ever calling me in. These dear friends of mine could not have provided such reassurances if I had been partially or totally inactive in the church. As it was, they knew my heart. They knew I was an insider in sentiment, no matter how unconventional some of my published ideas. Of course, no one can guarantee that church activity will protect anyone against church discipline, ill-advised or not, if an offended priesthood leader is determined to impose discipline, as Levina can tell you. But the probability of trouble, it seems to me, is greatly reduced if our ward and stake leaders have seen us laboring in the trenches, paying our tithing, getting our children into seminary, and preparing them for missions. My fourth suggestion is that we express our concerns to priesthood leaders behind closed doors and face to face, where we can look them in the eye and they can feel our positive and constructive spirits. Such an interview will be more impressive, furthermore, the closer is our personal relationship with the leader in question. I have my doubts, therefore, about the usefulness of wearing symbols or of writing letters about our concerns to leaders, especially if they don't know us well. When we also circulate copies of such letters privately, as I've known some saints to do, the letters will prove especially counterproductive, raising the leader's suspicion that our chief interest is in attracting attention to ourselves. Still less efficacious are collective demonstrations or petitions of any kind, whether within a ward community or in downtown Salt Lake City. Now, at this point, I need to say, find my footnote here, I'm passing no personal judgment on the motives or the conscientiousness of those who involve themselves in various kinds of public demonstrations, open letters, and the like. Every person must act for himself or herself in deciding how best to give expression to feelings of frustration, outrage, or sorrow in our religious community. Each must do what he or she has to do. The point I'm making here refers only to the likely efficacy of such tactics, which is an altogether different matter from what satisfies an individual's deep personal imperative for expression. It is true enough that the church, either through its leaders or through its public affairs office, will sometimes prove responsive to individual criticism from the outside, that is, from the media, from key opinion makers, and from high government officials. We can all cite changes that have apparently come about in response to such outside criticism. It is important to recognize, though, that public criticism from the inside does not have the same effect at all. Such is not the Mormon way, as I understand it. Members are expected to recognize that the church is not a democracy and that change does not come about through popular collective action. Applying the protest tactics and strategies of American citizens in the church setting is simply to emphasize the distance that the protester has already traveled from the Mormon way, and therefore to dissipate further such sympathy as he or she might have expected from other members or leaders. Nor are the public protests likely to garner much sympathy from friends and supporters outside the church, who simply tend to shake their heads and wonder why the protesting members don't just leave the church. In the Mormon way, conflict resolution and policy change do not take place in public settings. Indeed, one of the less healthy aspects of the Mormon way is the typical effort to pretend that there is really no conflict at all. However, at its best, the Mormon way also minimizes and contains conflict by seeking consensus slowly and quietly in small councils behind closed doors. To be sure, influences for change can be exerted also outside these councils, but those influences too take the form of private remonstrances with leaders from their friends, spouses, and children, all of which will ultimately inform the deliberations that will occur in those councils. Such, at least, is my reading of the Mormon way, and anyone who wishes to exert influence will do so quietly, privately, and among leaders who have learned to know him or her as a loyal insider. Finally, besides personal talks with leaders who know and trust us, there are a few other things we can do to make use of formal communication channels. We can write questions to the I Have a Question editor, the Ensign. In which we ask matter-of-fact questions about church policy on some of the areas of ambiguity that I have identified. Are members permitted on their own initiative to give talks on church history and doctrine without special permission outside of church meetings? Do LDS mothers who have careers outside the home retain good standing in the church? Do church leaders want the saints to avoid publications like Dialogue and Sunstone? As political activists in one interest group or another, are church members permitted to condone public policies as citizens that are more permissive than we would condone as church members, as in the abortion issue? Of course, such questions to the Ensign may or may not be published and answered. But a number of letters coming in now and then with the same questions from various areas of the church will at least indicate to our leaders the ambiguity that some saints feel on these questions. If we have good personal relationships with our stake presidents or even our bishops, we can also ask them to bring such questions to the attention of general authorities who periodically visit state conferences, emphasizing the need for clear and official responses of the general authorities on matters fundamental to church membership and good standing. A little bit sneaky, we can ask non-member friends, especially if they are highly visible or influential folks like college presidents or local government leaders, to write to the public affairs office of the church, posing inquiries about the official church stance on some of these questions, without indicating, of course, that church members have put them up to it. Finally, if you care about the church, be patient. Changes in policy and in intellectual climate have a cyclical tendency. This cycle, too, will pass. You will live to see it. Maybe I won't. Some of you will. The genuine concern, both spiritual and pragmatic, which our leaders have for spreading the gospel to exotic places and for retaining future generations of members in those places, will eventually necessitate a severe broadening of the boundaries of acceptability in the Mormon way of life. The few vexing intellectuals and feminists among us will yet prove to be the least of the issues with which future apostles will concern themselves. Pray to hasten the day. Thank you.
We have about 7 minutes. If any of you have any questions you'd like to ask Garland, I'm going to repeat the question for the tape. She asked, how do you feel about speaking up in Sunday school class when they raise an issue and you raise the possibility that there is another interpretation?
I very much approve of doing that. I think the question becomes how you do it. I think a lot of times when we, through our reading, have gained obviously superior knowledge to the people in the class, it's very easy to become condescending. And we have to really avoid that tone. If those of us who read and think want to be treated with respect and love from those who are more fundamentalist in their orientations, then we have to treat them the same way. So I think it's really important to take that posture. And then I also think it's important to raise the questions as questions. That is not to say, well, you know, you should know that so-and-so said this or so-and-so said that. But instead, when you get some outrageous comment from a class member or the teacher of the class, say, I'm curious about that point you just made. Where did you get that from the scriptures? Or, you know, see, just raise the question. And that will, I think, make the point without, you know, coming in as a big, heavy intellectual in the class, which will be resented very much.
Okay.
Yeah, you are. You seem very knowledgeable on that subject. That's very interesting. the question is whether it's not also a problem that generates ambiguity to see what so often happens in the society also happening in the church, namely that members invent infractions not covered by the letter of the law faster than the law can be changed to keep up with them. And sure, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And that's why it's all the more important that it seems to me local leaders should be very wary about proceeding against a person until they really see that there's a gospel principle at stake. One of the things that has distressed me over the years is how often people are disciplined for matters in which there is no gospel principle at stake. I mean, how can it possibly matter how long some kid wears his hair, if he's lucky enough to have hair? You know. I mean, what is the gospel principle at stake there? And I think that as priesthood leaders, indeed as parents, we ought to be careful about where we take our stands and be sure that there's really an important principle involved before we take a stand and hassle somebody about it. Yes, Lou.
What trouble you have?
Yeah, the question is, shouldn't we really rejoice in the ambiguity? Because the less ambiguity, the more rigid the rules. In a general way, I'd say yes. But what I a main theme that's one that runs through my message this morning is that that ambiguity, and remember the distinction I made when I said that I'm not advocating a Pharisee-like list of do's and don'ts. What I'm talking about is the very terms of our membership in the church. About those, I don't think we can tolerate any ambiguity. We need to know what are the basic terms of our membership in the church. And what happens with ambiguity in that is that different priesthood leaders who are disposed to do so use the ambiguity against the saints instead of allowing it to be to expand our freedom of agency. John Targen. Yeah, the question is the emerging philosophy in corporate America is to reduce centralized control, right, and put more decision making at the lower levels of company. I think that's true. That is, I think, as I understand it too, the emerging philosophy of the corporate world. And I strongly suspect that philosophy will work its way into the philosophy of the general authorities. My parting remarks really alluded to that when I was emphasizing how I think we can expect change in the church to come in large part from exotic places in the church where top-down management and Wasatch Front thinking just have no relevance. And so there's going to have to be a decentralization of decision-making or the church won't thrive. So I think that's a good point. Lori had a question.
Last question.
Yeah. The observation is that following the comment that we need to be sure that when we take a stand, it's on something that involves a gospel principle. It's unfortunate that obedience has come to be seen in the church by many as a gospel principle in its own right, and is used to make almost any kind of demand on the membership. And I think that's right. I think we need in our gentle and loving way to resist and reject the idea that there is any such thing as a gospel principle called obedience in the abstract. If you want to talk about obedience to somebody, if you want to talk about obedience to a gospel principle, fine. But not obedience as a kind of open-ended demand. There, I don't think that's to be found in the scriptures or in the traditions of the church. I'm sorry, our time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you for your participation.
Hope the rest of the day is as exciting as this.
My pleasure. Thank you.